Who among us is not fascinated by the annual life cycle of salamanders? They start from eggs, they go to larvae, to brightly spotted adulthood. And as spring warms our lakes and ponds, we're going to be hearing the frogs and other creatures calling out from our local wetlands. And it's a great time to explore all that close up. My guest today has written a book that is, I think, well, it's for children. It's really, I tell you what, I really enjoyed it myself. And I think so, let's say kids of all ages are in for a treat here. As environmental educator David Fitzsimmons joins in to uncover the magic of wetlands and vernal pools. He is the author of a new book, children's book called Salamander Dance, and he will share tips for spotting these creatures in local wetlands, and he has some other great ideas to get parents and kids into nature. Are you captivated by salamanders and some of the other creatures that live in your local wetlands? I hope you'll join in your conversation with your own experiences and with your own questions. Call in 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page, our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. And David Fitzsimmons, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hey, Larry, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Oh, man, what a beautiful book. It's so well written, and the artwork is stunning.
Well, I got to work with Connecticut artist Michael DiGiorgio, probably best known for unsigned works in many of the North American field guides, like the Peterson Guide and others. So he's been doing natural history illustration for years, just finished an exhibit at the Roger Torrey Peterson Institute. So he's a real fixture in American natural history painting.
Well, it's just really a wonderful, wonderful paintings. And your writing is great. You've helped kids explore the worlds of many creatures. What inspired you to kind of pull back the reeds, so to speak, on salamanders?
I like your metaphor, yeah. I have been interested in children and nature from a very early age. When I was in school, my mom was an elementary school teacher, and I used to go to children's literature conferences where I'd hear all kinds of authors, including, you know, great natural history writers like Jean Craighead George of the family affiliated with the National Geographic magazine. And so as a young boy, my dad was an outdoor educator, and so over the years, every spring when we'd have the mass migrations of salamanders, we'd grab flashlights and go out in that first warm rain. And Larry, you probably know that means like 33 degrees.
Yeah.
And we'd head out. And so as a boy, I was tromping around in the woods looking at these cool amphibians doing their mass migrations. And I wrote a book for Kent State University Press here in Ohio on animals of Ohio's ponds and vernal pools. And when I did a bibliography, I included a section for parents to see what they could read to kids. And I was shocked to find that there were no books out about children and for children about vernal pools. So that really lit the fire under me. I said, you know, we really need to get kids interested in this unique natural habitat.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and I can tell you that I'm taking your book to my daughter's school, and that a couple of copies of that book are going to go into the library. My daughter's 12, but I think pretty much any age child from 5 years old to 100 probably are going to benefit from this book.
Well, I try to write my children's books, and that includes my Curious Critter series, the first children's picture book and the series that came out of that, and the Salamander Dance book, so it appeals to a wide range of ages. That includes both the content in the narrative itself and then also additional, more complex natural history information in the back that, you know, is suitable for teachers or older brothers or sisters or, hey, people like you and me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's really a fascinating read. I had a caller online, and we just lost that caller, unfortunately. That's too bad. Let's talk about the whole process here, the salamander, the dance. When did, first, this happens in a vernal pool.
That's right. So the vernal pools, if you're not familiar with a vernal pool, it's a small depression, a basin in the landscape, much smaller typically than a pond. And the thing about it is they're not fed with springs or they're not connected to rivers typically. They could be anything from just a depression that's in the landscape, maybe left from glacial effects, you know, thousands of years ago. They can occur on sand dunes where a blowout occurs, even where an uprooted tree can leave, you know, a sizable hole. And so those fill with water seasonally, and that means that typically they dry up in the summer. And the key thing about that is these vernal pools do not have fish in them. And those predators being absent allow animals like wood frogs and the spotted salamander and other ambystoma, like the, I know you've got blue spotted salamanders and tiger salamanders in Wisconsin. Those yep. types of mole salamanders come out from their underground holes where they stay much of the year, the burrows made by moles and other animals. And they travel to the vernal pool once it fills with water, melting snow or spring rains, and that's their breeding habitat.
And it's I know here in Madison, where our program is originating from, Madison, Wisconsin, we have folks who go out and watch for and sort of help direct salamanders across streets.
Good for them, absolutely. It's a treacherous endeavor. A university here in Ohio did a study of the various things, the impediments in the way of salamanders migrating, and things like developments as we build, and roadways and farm fields. And those roadways are certainly one of the most dangerous things. It's good to hear that there are some locations where people will either close down the roads or help shepherd them across. There are even some locations where they'll build tunnels so that yep. the ditches will funnel them toward an underground tunnel where they can then cross the roadway underneath and pass through toward their vernal pools.
Lynn and Paloma up with a comment. Lynn, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was a fifth grade teacher, and I had this amazing group of about 8-10-year-old boys that really got interested in salamanders. And I ended up buying a 125-gallon aquarium that we turned into a salamander habitat. And the kids just had the best time with it. And I have salamander earrings, and I have salamanders on my science shirt that I wear when we do science. And I had salamander little things that would clip on my shoes. And so I guess I've become the salamander woman for these little boys.
Oh, what a great story. David?
Oh, I even have one that's a pin and it's little tail wigs.
You know, Lynn, it's stories like that that are so fascinating and so important to me, because what we're really, you know, the major goal I have is getting kids interested in nature. And clearly, Lynn, what you did there with the salamanders in your room and then reinforcing it with, you know, even wearing the salamander jewelry and whatnot, it helps kids get excited. When they're excited about nature, then they just want to keep learning about it and they want to spend more time in nature. And research is increasingly suggesting that's exactly what we need, is connection with animals and connection with the natural environment.
Well, and it made the boys read, what do salamanders eat? Should we go by crickets? What should we buy? What should we do? You know, what temperature the water should be kept at? And out of those 10 boys, two of them are doctors today.
Oh, that's great. You know,
and they were both into herpetology, and they had, you know, bearded lizards and all this kind of stuff that their mothers let them have at home. But it led to wonderful careers.
That kind of an authentic instruction where the students then have their own self-directed research and they're working on an actual real-world project, taking care of animals, learning about a habitat. It's so important. I'm not surprised that they went on to develop, you know, successful careers. That's so. I'm so glad to hear your story, Lynn.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling, Lynn. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. So that was a pretty cool way to get, I think, kids interested in involved in nature and the out of doors. What are some other effective ways to get kids interested?
Well, Larry, you know, there are a lot of ways that we can do it very simply right in our backyards and in, you know, the neighborhoods around us. And a very simple way is to take a walk. And one of the things, sometimes people think, well, I live in the city, but there's nature all around us. You've got everything from weeds growing out of cracks in the sidewalks to that little spot beside the house that you can't keep mowed. And if you go poke around in that spot, you're going to find all kinds of cool insects you know, just getting out and walking, a 10-minute walk wherever you live, you're going to encounter things like birds. And in Wisconsin, as it is here in Ohio, there's quite a bit of diversity of wildlife and just a chance to get out in nature. But, you know, more specifically, there are a lot of stores and a lot of places where you can get support for bird watching, local nature centers, and learn some of those animals. Kids love to be able to come close to various types of animals, and bird watching is one of those easy activities. And of course, as a photographer, I have to promote the idea of taking pictures. You know, it used to be you had to spend hundreds or thousands of dollars to get all kinds of equipment. Now we can take amazing pictures with our cell phones. Nearly everybody's got a phone that can take an amazing photograph, and it's so easy now to take those pictures and share them and get other people charged about nature.
Yeah, and you write, obviously are very skilled. You write for Outdoor Photographer and Popular Photography and Shutterbug. There are no photos in your Salamander Dance book, but photography has obviously played a very important role in your life.
It has, and you know, my first introduction into the children's field, writing children's books, was when I came out with my first book, Curious Critters, and that introduces kids to common backyard animals. The cover features a gray tree frog, its big golden black eyes staring at you, and each of the animals in the book, you get a chance to view them eye to eye. And so some of the books that I write, I do the writing and work with other artists like I did with Mike and the Curious Critters series. If people want to see more pictures in that, it's curious-critters.com. The website has all kinds of information about that. And that was my chance to get people to connect directly to my photographs of nature, specifically backyard wildlife, not exotic things, but the things you find right in your own backyards, because developmentally, that's the best way to get kids really connecting with nature.
Yeah, and there, you're right, there's a lot in a backyard.
Absolutely. You know, if you can go back and plant something, you know, plant a bush or a tree, and you're going to dig up larvae, grub, you're going to turn up worms. If you just look at the trunk of a tree and you get in close, you're going to find small insects crawling along. And, of course, if you've got a tree, you probably have got woodpeckers around, so you can sit back and watch them use that amazing long tongue peck away. And there's no end. If you give yourself 10 minutes to sit outside, you're going to see some kind of wildlife.
David Fitzsimmons, our guest today, having some fun with talking with him today. His latest book is titled Salamander Dance, explores the wonders of salamanders and vernal pools. I hope you'll join in with your own salamander question or maybe experience or other nature experience at 1-800-642-1234. We'll be back after the news. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the fascinating world of salamanders, and just taking a look, also a discussion, I think, of getting youngsters involved in the out of doors, keeping them, getting them out of the house, off the sofa, and in the out of doors. And I think the book Salamander Dance can help that process, because I think it can give youngsters curiosity about salamanders and maybe about other things in the out-of-doors. Our guest today is a freelance photographer and environmental educator, David Fitzsimmons. He's the author of Salamander Dance, and it really explores the annual life cycle of salamanders and vernal pools. And David, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, absolutely, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too, as you're listening in. A question, comment, or maybe an experience to share, call in 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. By the way, if you got a cool photo of a salamander, that would be great to put up on our Facebook page. I'd love to see that as well. So, got a good photo? Post it up. And let's take some calls. I think Barbara up next. Barbara, oh, I guess we're having a little trouble getting her on. Well, we'll come back to her in just a second here. If you're thinking about you know, I wonder. Here, let's go to Barbara. Barbara, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, hi. Yeah, we have redback salamanders, and they get it down by our basement door, which is below ground level. And we, last year we moved 50 of them out. We have sort of a pond by our house, so they come down there, and we pick them up and bring them outside and put them back in a wet area.
Oh.
So we did that to 50 of them last year.
Redback salamanders. Oh, that interesting.
Yes.
They're an interest.
We also had some babies. There were babies down there, little teeny weeny. They're identical to the adults, miniature, a half an inch, I don't know, real small. But they're just like a replica, miniature replica of the adult.
Oh. David, you know anything about redback salamanders?
The redback salamanders, here in Ohio, we find them as well as you've got them up there in Wisconsin. They're a beautiful little salamander. What's interesting is they're actually two different color phases. You can get the redback salamander. There's actually a lead-backed phase of the redback salamander. So you might find one that you didn't think was actually red-backed, but they also have this. And I wonder, Barbara, if you had any of the other coloration that had kind of the grayish, almost bluish color to them.
No, I don't.
They were all red.
Yeah, you must have the perfect habitat. They do like woodlands, and so you must have had the right sort of moisture and maybe some leaf litter or something that they found very suitable.
Very cool.
I did want to ask, can you tell how, do you know how you can tell the difference between a male and a female?
I don't know on that particular animal. A lot of times... some animals, it takes, you'd have to do some kind of microscopic analysis to see the inside of the animal, or even sometimes it has to be a genetic analysis. On this particular one, there's probably a way to know maybe during breeding season, but I'm not familiar with the differentiation on those.
All right. Barbara, thanks so much. The salamander you have on the cover of your book and throughout the book is not a redback salamander.
It is not. It's a spotted salamander, which there is in Wisconsin a blue spotted salamander. It looks very similar, but has blue spots. This one's actually not called the yellow spotted. They just call it the spotted salamander. It's a very common salamander across North America, much particularly the East and up into Canada, and very common in woodlands. They hide in burrows. They're in a group of salamanders called mole salamanders, and that's appropriately named. They live in the burrows underground that moles and other mammals will make, and then appear. So you may not see them much of the rest of the year unless they just happen to poke up, maybe foraging for food. They'll be very secretive underground until that special breeding time when they head out to the vernal pools.
Yeah, and they're a cool-looking salamander. It's a cool-looking animal.
They are. The bright yellow spots against the black background on the, and then the little grayish color on the belly. And if you look at them just right, they almost look like they're smiling at you.
There we go. Joseph in Madison has up next. Hi, yes. Joseph.
Hello. Yeah, I've lived in Madison for quite a few years, and I've always noticed that on Gammon, recently there was a sign put up by a small little lake up there in Middleton, and it says on the sign, Salamander Crossing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought this was a joke. but there, I mean, what do they cross the road, or what's the deal? And how could we see them? How could we go see them?
That's a really good question, Joseph. In fact, Larry, you mentioned my book, Salamander Dance, and we were talking about the back matter. I actually show a picture in the back of the book of a salamander crossing sign in the areas that are really dense woodlands where these salamanders migrate. And I should clarify here, when I say these salamanders migrate to vernal pools, imagine a vernal pool that is about 20 feet by 30 feet, so a fairly small size, maybe the size of a very large great room. In a vernal pool that size, you could have 1,000 or more salamanders in that small area. Even a smaller pool than that could have 1,000 or more on a good year. And that means that there are a huge number of salamanders that on the best nights, though, if you have a good, strong, warm rain for the first rain of the year, you may have 70, 80, 90% of the population moving on that one night, and they will just continue in a continual march, move across roadways. And so those signs may be up all year and may look funny in the middle of the dry summer, but in the spring, those are really important because if you're watching, if your headlights particularly on low and you're keeping an eye out for a moving salamander, they're about 9 inches long, there's a good chance you could see, if you drive a mile of a roadway in that area, half a dozen to a dozen salamanders just in that short span of highway.
And, Joseph, you could probably park yourself right about near that sign.
Yeah.
Because they travel at night.
Yeah, so, you know, what I do is I travel with the low headlights on until I see them, and then I jump out and I go look at the salamander, try to figure out what species it is. Here in Ohio, we have one called a Jefferson salamander, named after our, of course, famous naturalist Thomas Jefferson. And so you'll find a mixture of whatever species in your area, maybe some tiger salamanders migrating to their vernal pools. And, yeah, you just going out at night. So anywhere from, you know, nightfall on a rainy, early spring rainy night. Here in Ohio, we're talking maybe in March. You're a little bit north of us, so, you know, it could be late March, maybe even early April in a late year, if you hit it just right. So if you watch that roadway, you will probably see them. And the other thing is to build a network of people. If you're very interested in this, the local nature centers will know when they're going to migrate approximately, and a lot of them will have something set up where they can let you know through Facebook or some other notification system so you can quickly gather and go out with them, you know, early night, 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and actually go out with high volume light and see them actually in the pool swimming and doing, as you mentioned, Larry, that dance where they're swimming around each other.
Yeah, it's pretty cool to see that sort of circular dance. I don't know, is it circular dance?
Yeah, so some people mistake the swimming to the surface of the pool. So the spotted salamanders will actually go from the bottom of the pool. And the pool may only be 12, 16 inches deep, but they'll swim to the top and actually take in air. They are lunged salamanders. The dance actually occurs where the male and female just circle around each other. The male will circle around the female, nudge her with his snout in a very soft, gentle way. And that's how they, you know, introduce themselves to each other. And that begins the process of laying the eggs and the fertilization of the eggs.
You know, it's interesting to me because I've watched and seen my daughter is a huge manatee fanatic. She loves manatees, and so we've actually done some kayaking and that with manatees or in the manatee areas. And the motion of manatees, who a male and a female together, is quite a lot like the look of the salamander dance.
That's interesting. Maybe a difference in a couple orders of magnitude and size, but beyond that, very the gentle way that these salamanders treat each other it's very moving. The watching the salamanders, to me, and I've been impressed. We launched the book about 3 weeks ago, and the response has been amazing. I think people are fascinated with these gentle creatures. They're not intimidating. They're not, you know, scary like some people have a fear of snakes. They're a fun and very interesting, intriguing animal.
Oh, they are. You know, let's talk about the sort of the life cycle. Do you want to go through it for us?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, so the salamanders will be in the winter. So if we kind of think back a couple months here, they would be underground during the winter. They would be hibernating underground. Their metabolism slowed down quite a bit. But as things start to warm up in the spring, the vernal pools will start. The ice will disappear from vernal pools, particularly in the north where you and I are. And so they will start to, those pools will start to melt. And once their circadian clock helps them understand what time of the year it is, they feel the temperatures warming up, they will emerge during that first warm rain, and it needs to be raining, so they're not coming out on a spring night that's dry with their sensitive skin that has to maintain moisture. They'll come out in the rain in the dark, so as you mentioned earlier to Joseph, they're migrating in the dark throughout the night, and they will come to the vernal pool. Often the males will arrive before the females, but on a year that's timed right, they'll all arrive at that vernal pool almost on the same night, and so you can get these thousands of them. And I should add, they typically join other amphibians, such as wood frogs, who will be making a kind of a clacking or quacking noise, and so it's kind of raucous what's going on in the vernal pools. And then the males and females will do that dance where they gently nudge each other, and the males will leave what's called a spermatophore, a little white object on the bottom of the pool, and the female will pick that up, and she will then fertilize her eggs and lay them, and then she leaves, and he leaves. So they head back and go back underground, and they're underground for the rest of the year. But at that point, the eggs start to develop, and so in a matter of weeks, the little larvae, which may be about the size of your pinky fingernail, will start to develop. And it's really cool, Larry. I photographed those egg masses, and they seem to be phototropic. They seem to turn their heads up toward, or geotropic, one way or another, towards the sky. And so they're all in these little crescent shapes inside the eggs. And then they will emerge. They'll pop out of the eggs, and when they come out, they are tiny. I mean, like, imagine just the tip of a pencil. If you sharpened a number two pencil and looked at just that black lead part, that's about the size they are when they come out of the egg. And they have little feather-like gills that are sticking out at the side of their heads. They're just little buds when they come out. But they grow into these fascinating filamented structures that allow them to breathe underwater. And so they swim and they eat tiny microorganisms, and they grow in size and start to eat small insect larvae and things. And then the cool thing is they can actually sense how fast their vernal pools are drying up. So remember, these vernal pools are temporary. They typically dry in the summer. So as the vernal pool starts to dry up, somehow they sense the speed with which it is, and they can develop their juvenile stage where they lose their gills, and they grow lungs, and they grow feet, and the tail comes out, and all of a sudden they emerge from the pool.
It's absolutely amazing to me. What a fun thing to learn about. John in Dunn has something. John, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. I tuned in a little bit late this morning, but did you get a description of what a vernal pool is from their guest? I don't know what that is.
Okay, yeah, we did, but let's talk about it again.
Yeah, sure. So, John, a vernal pool is a temporary wetland. It's like a pond, but very small. So a small depression landscape could be from an upturned rootstock of a tree. Sometimes areas that have been glaciated, there may be just a low area. Maybe it used to be a pond and it's slowly filled in, just gets wet. So it fills up with melting snow or early spring rains, and then typically they dry out in the summer. And that's a really critical feature because fish can't live in that environment, and those would be predators of amphibians like the salamanders and other things like frogs. And so that makes it a very special breeding habitat for these mole salamanders, like the spotted salamander in my Salamander Dance book.
Yeah.
Thank you. How do they find these vernal pools? Is it passed on in their genes, or what? How do they know where to go?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So scientists have studied, and when a salamander is born in that pool, there is a very strong chance that it's going to return to its original pool. So what that geolocating mechanism is, it must be something similar to what birds use to migrate. But they do find that a certain percent, maybe 10%, a certain percent actually will migrate to a different pool. If you think about that from an evolutionary standpoint, that's advantageous because it mixes the gene pool in each of the vernal pools. And so they can spread, you know, whatever their beneficial characteristics are to other habitats and to other populations. And so not everyone will return, but somehow they are able to use that sense of migration and return to the same pool, most of them, year after year. And by the way, when they do change into juveniles, they actually don't return for about 3 or 4 or 5 years, depending on how far north they are. It takes them that long to reach maturity, and then when they can do, reach sexual maturity so they can be part of the reproduction process, then they will return to the pool at that age.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And when they're in these tunnels, they're eating worms and what else?
Yeah, so that, think about what could be crawling underground, things like insect larvae, little grubs, they might find some ants or things like that. So any kind of small organism that could find its way underground, if you turn some dirt over with a shovel, you may see some small insect larvae or things like that. And so they'll eat those. And, of course, worms, they're pretty wide range in terms of the types of things that they will eat. They're not vegetarian. They will eat various meats, so they're carnivores. But it's a pretty humble life experience underground there.
I'm sure. You know, I was thinking about this, thinking about your book and thinking about issues like climate change and wondering how something like climate change could impact salamanders.
Well, that's a really good question. Salamanders and more generally amphibians are a great indicator species of the health of an environment. So they can, help us understand whether there are pollutants in an environment. And you can see because they need these temporary pools and they have to have a certain amount of water, it's, as things warm up in various regions, you're going to find those pools drying up faster and faster. And, of course, while they can adjust that developmental period, if the pool dries out faster in one particular year, you can imagine that, if the period draws too short, the pool would then become unsuitable for reproduction, even if it were, accelerated in some way. So I would think that we would find that some pools in areas that are growing warmer and warmer may no longer be viable. By the same token, perhaps areas to the north that might be getting warmer may become more suitable. So you might see a change in the range of various salamanders as that happens. And that's speculation. I'm not a research scientist, but I think that's probably what we would expect to see in a general way.
Are there things that we can do to help support the natural life cycles, maybe of the pools or the wetlands?
Absolutely. I think the number one thing that we can do is education. Get out there and study the pools. If you are a parent or a grandparent and you have kids, introduce them to vernal pools. And if you don't know much about it, if this is the first time you've heard about them, besides reading books, getting to the nature centers and asking somebody, just asking who knows something about vernal pools. Right now, even though salamanders may have already migrated, the eggs are in the pools. And if you find a naturalist who can point you to the vernal pool, you can go over and actually sit there and study them. If you've got a naturalist who knows where the pool is, may be able to walk over and actually lift the eggs out gently and show you what they look like as they're developing. And then beyond that, now that we have started learning about the pools themselves, you can start searching for them on your own properties. Maybe you have one right behind your house or in the local woodland, and maybe nobody knows it. And then you could even take another step. Because of development, we have started losing vernal pool habitats. And as I did here on my property in Ohio, I built a vernal pool. There are a whole range of ways to build them, from simply taking a backhoe and digging a hole to, in our case, we took some rubble from a construction project. Instead of putting it in a landfill, we used that to build one wall against a hill and used a pond liner. Of course, there's my favorite method that's recommended in one of the online guides in West Virginia, and that's a quarter stick of dynamite. I don't necessarily recommend that unless you have an expertise in that area, but that always fascinates me.
But that would be the fun way.
Wouldn't it?
I love that. Well, now, have you been able to attract salamanders to your vernal pool?
Yeah, so I built that pool back when I was working on the book for Kent State University. That was back in 2011. And currently we have wood frogs, a huge population of wood frogs that comes each year. In fact, when they have the juveniles have developed from their tadpoles and leave the pool to head out into the woodlands, they are so populous that we have to not go near the vernal pool. It's like popcorn, like little jumping pieces of popcorn all over the ground. How did salamanders come in? And then you'll get occasional other animals. Sometimes wood ducks will land on the vernal pool. You'll see insects like dragonflies flying around. So it can be a very vital environment. And I should mention, Larry, one of the concerns that people have is, well, if I build a vernal pool behind my house, am I going to have increased mosquitoes? And the answer is, if you've got the nice population of animals living in that pool, they're going to feed upon those insect larvae. And so that would be the ideal scenario, is once you get that population established, you have natural predators for the larvae themselves.
Oh, cool. You know, we have some great photos posted up on our Facebook page. Marcia sent photos of some blue-spotted salamanders from their place near the Turtle Flambeau Flowage, which is one of my favorite spots. And then there are also some a photo of some red-backed salamanders as well. So that's very cool. I really have enjoyed your book, and as I said earlier, it's going to go to my daughter's school, and I'm going to talk to one of the teachers about it. Do you have it? Is it really aimed at a particular age group?
Well, it's aimed at elementary school students. That would be the number one thing. I have found a lot of people say, well, you know, there are words in it, and I can't use it with, you know, 1 or 2 year olds. But read it to them. Hold the book so they don't tear the pages, and let them see the pictures, those spectacular, brightly colored images made by Michael DiGiorgio, who's an outstanding natural history illustrator. Let them look at those pictures and make the sounds of the wood frog on the early pages of the book. So I would recommend it for anyone from ages, say, 2 or 3 till about 10 or 12. But even then, you know, it's a great resource for somebody who's just learning about it. I love reading picture books the first time I learn about a subject, because it's a simplified way to learn about it.
No, I sure enjoyed reading through it and looking at the photos. David, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure talking with you. And next time you have another book out, we'll want to hear from you again.
Oh, you bet. And if you want to see pages, go to salamanderdance.com. There are sample pages there. So check it out. Thanks, Larry.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. And we have a link on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show as well. David Fitzsimmons, our guest today. He is an award-winning freelance photographer and author, and he has written a book called Salamander Dance. It's a wonderful book. It's aimed at children, but you know what? I really enjoyed it, too, and I bet you would as well. So great to have him along. And great, it was kind of a good show. We had a couple of great authors who have a lot of enthusiasm, and it was really a lot of fun. So we've got more shows. One, of course, coming up tomorrow. We'll be getting the latest trip tips on travel from our guest on tomorrow's program, and I hope you'll join in with your own destinations and your questions then. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.